I'm honored to be joined today by Dr. Adrienne Belts. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, where she directs the Methods, Sex Differences, and Development Lab. Dr. Belts is an expert in how sex hormones influence brain development, including prenatally, during puberty, across the menstrual cycle, and via hormonal contraceptives, and how all of these help explain sex differences in cognition, behavior, and psychopathology. Adrienne, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me today.
I think it would be great to begin our conversation distinguishing between organizational and activational effects of hormones.
Yeah, that's a great point. And also a bit of a gray area. We don't know in some cases and we do know in others, but the traditional definitions of organizational hormones are hormone exposures that occur during often sensitive periods of development, basically when the brain was primed and expecting those hormone exposures. And so when those hormone exposures happen, they seem to set or organize or establish particular brain circuits in ways that then persist across some period of time, as long as the lifespan. So those are organizational effects, whereas activational effects traditionally are then hormone exposures that occur at other points in time that basically activate or initiate, they work on those circuits that have already been established organizationally. And so they have more of what we think of as maybe commonplace, the on-off mechanism. When those hormones are present, they're doing the things influencing the behaviors we would expect. And when those hormones aren't present, then we don't see those behaviors.
If we're talking about critical periods of development, whether that's prenatally or during puberty, you're seeing organizational effects of hormones. And then things like contraceptives or puberty blockers or diet or steroids, right? Across the menstrual cycle, all of these would be activational effects.
We're already getting into that gray area. I would say yes for things like the menstrual cycle, but it's less clear for things like puberty, for instance. What effects are organizational versus what effects could be activational? Even for hormonal contraceptives as well, we think of these as activational effects traditionally, but some emerging work suggests they might also be organizational, especially if they occur during those sensitive periods like adolescence. The organizational activational distinctions are useful, but I think it in some cases it's difficult to bin a particular hormone exposure into organizational or activational. It's either not clear or could be both, or it depends on the person.
Another heuristic that I've used is organizational refers to brain structure and activational refers to function or to connectivity, which can change much more rapidly. But then I saw some studies showing even across the menstrual cycle, week to week, you're seeing small but significant changes in brain structure, which is really strange to think about because I think aside from development over long spans of time, structure is more or less fixed. And I was imagining like this hippocampus ballooning in and out very subtly, and you can pick up on that in an MRI scan. And so that heuristic, it's probably still useful, but definitely gray, like you mentioned.
Yeah, I think the heuristic can be useful, but also it depends on the level of analysis. If we're talking about humans, we don't have yet a super understanding of how brain structure and function map onto each other. There clearly has to be a relationship, although it's a difficult one to detect with the tools and in the ways in which we work in human research. This is a place where I think a lot of animal models and molecular research could be very helpful because, of course, when the hormones are present, they have to be interacting with some neuron, some cell in the brain that's having a physical change that then influences function. It has to be both structural and functional, but detecting that at the big complex level of the human brain, I think, is where that gray area comes in.
This is a good place to bring up different methods. I can think of broadly three categories, but tell me if I'm missing anything. So one would be the traditional experimental research where you're literally manipulating hormones, and usually it's done in animals and not humans for ethical reasons. And then there's human natural experiments where you're not manipulating anything, but sometimes due to different genetic disorders, you might have abnormal hormone levels, and it almost serves as a test case if they're normal in all other ways. There's a control group and then different experimental conditions of which hormone levels are affected by different types of disorders. And then the third would just be correlational. So you're not looking at experimental manipulation, but you're saying, okay, there are natural individual differences in circulating hormone levels, and there's natural individual differences in, say, brain size that we can measure through neuroimaging. And then you're looking for statistical associations between those.
Yeah, I think those are three broad classes. It's also interesting to think about maybe the intersections of those classes. For instance, I think of hormonal contraceptive use as a natural experiment. It's not necessarily linked to genetics, but there's hundreds of millions of people walking around the world taking, for instance, a particular dose of a particular hormone or set of hormones every day at the same time.
Maybe we could walk through some of the history of that. Because one thing I remember learning is that like 70 years ago, the doses were massively higher. And then over time, you figured out you can get the same effect with less of an extreme manipulation.
Yeah, it really depends on the type of hormonal contraceptive we're talking about. The most well-known and most widely used, at least in North America and Europe, is oral contraceptives or the pill. And they work by basically turning off the ovaries, suppressing ovarian function, and they overtake that feedback loop of ovarian hormones that's typically done endogenously by the body or within the body with exogenous or synthetic or outside the body hormones. And over time, scholars have learned, chemists have learned, and consistent with more modern medical practice, we want a hormone dose that's strong enough to suppress ovarian function and not any stronger than that. And so what exactly that dose is much less today than it was many years ago, thank goodness, because there was much more risk associated with that, with the higher doses. And we also know it depends on the person, right? That's why some pill formulations can work fine for some people, but not for other people. One way we know it's not might not be working well for some people or completely suppressing ovarian function is when you see something called breakthrough bleeding during contraceptive or hormonal contraceptive usage.
Are there any long-term harms or side effects to this ovarian suppression?
That's a good question. I think right now the field is working really to understand short-term side effects. And we're really just beginning the studies that investigate long-term side effects. In this context, though, it's really important to contextualize side effects. We tend to view them as a negative thing. And maybe for some people in some situations, they are. And that's true. But the ovarian function, the suppression of ovarian function can be wonderful for folks with particular reproductive health conditions. And so hormonal contraceptives are very effective treatments in many cases. And so-called side effects of hormonal contraceptives should really be compared against side effects of things like an unwanted pregnancy. So it's really a complex situation and a personal decision about how the pros and cons get weighed and weighted for a particular person.
And also occasionally they're used not even for anything to do with contraception, right? Like maybe to reduce cramps or other. I think in PCOS, you also see some use of contraceptives.
Exactly. Yep. That's what I was referring to with use for like reproductive health conditions, PCOS, sometimes endometriosis, dysmenorrhea, which is very painful periods, sometimes amenorrhea, which is the loss of periods, and other conditions. And I think that usage is a lot higher than many folks realize. A large proportion of folks are using completely or in part to those reasons. Things like dysmenorrhea are much more common. It's actually the majority of the sex-assigned female population.
When talking about sort of folk theories about how the hormones are working, I could see them going to two extremes. One extreme is it's really tricking your body into a state that you'd be in 3 out of 4 weeks of the month anyway. So there's no real harm there. And then the other thought is this is like long-term injection of chemicals into your body. It's unnatural. It's potentially harmful. Where's the middle ground there?
Yeah, I think an argument for the middle ground is that the brain is an endocrine organ. We started today by talking about some of the different periods of the lifespan when our brain and bodies change in response to hormones, from prenatal development through puberty, regularly across the menstrual cycle, into menopause. For males, also, there's a daily rhythm of testosterone, for all of us, daily rhythms of things like cortisol. And so the brain is an endocrine organ that has evolved to respond to these chemical inputs. And what a good choice for someone is about whether the body is being tricked or, right, these arguments that it's not natural. What if the natural cycle of things causes so much pain in a teenager that, due to dysmenorrhea, for instance, that she can't go to school 3 days every month? So having some sort of treatment that helps reduce that pain so that she can function at her best level and meet her potential, that's a really important consideration. So I think the middle ground is appreciating that the brain has to respond to these inputs, and only an individual in their own situation with their own sets of kind of pros and cons and wants and needs or limitations can make the best choice about use or not.
I'm curious how the hormones actually work. You mentioned it's effectively turning off the ovaries. So when I hear turning off, my mind instantly goes to antagonist. It's blocking the receptor. But then I was learning about puberty blockers recently, and you hear about GnRHAs. The GnRH is this signaling hormone that's released from the brain and triggers this whole cascade of pubertal processes. And then A, I assumed, was going to be antagonist. You block GnRH and you block that whole cycle. And then it turns out it's actually an agonist. And naturally, the brain is releasing GnRH in these pulses. And if it's an agonist that's just constantly firing, then you don't get that cyclical rhythm that the brain is expecting. And that's why it turns it off. So it turns it off by flooding it with an on signal as opposed to just stopping the signaling. And are contraceptives more similar to that or more similar to the classic antagonist blocking or something else?
It really depends on what type of hormonal contraceptive we're talking about. What we've been talking about so far is the pills. And basically, yeah, they overtake that feedback loop. There's enough of the hormone present in the system that the body says, oh, that's regulating for me. Other forms of hormonal contraceptives like IUDs, they work very differently. In hormonal IUDs, there's the local introduction of only progesterone or synthetic progesterone, which are called progestins, and they can influence some aspects of the local morphology, increase cervical mucus, thin the endometrium, and they provide contraceptive actions in that ways. And there's a lot less clarity about how and to what extent those intrauterine hormones and enter the bloodstream and play a role in any of those types of feedback mechanisms. We're still learning a lot about that.
But we've been talking a lot about the biological effects, and there's also a huge psychological literature on this. Especially the one that stands out most to me is looking at attraction preferences in women, how they change either across the cycle or on versus off contraceptives. And you hear these evolutionary explanations that when women are ovulating, they're more attracted to hypermasculine features. And when they're not ovulating or on contraceptives, they're attracted to softer features. Does that hold up, or is that sort of has that become pop psych?
The research on hormonal contraceptives, like research on most things, is very tricky, and there's a great deal of nuance. And we've learned a lot relatively recently, meaning in the last 5 to 10 years, about how to do this work well, and some of the factors that we really need to consider in this work. It's not just about folks who do and don't use oral contraceptives, for instance. We know that, I like to say, not all oral contraceptives, not all pills are even created equal. Some pills just have progestin in them. That's called the min pill. It's common, for instance, if folks are chest feeding. And there's other types of pills that called combined pills that contain both progestin and estradiol, so synthetic progesterone and synthetic estrogen. And even among those, there's different hormone involvement. For instance, some progestins are derived from androgens, so also have some androgen binding action, and some are not. They're considered anti-androgenic progestins. So even in this whole class of oral contraceptives, there's a great deal of variability. And then the variability in those pills, right, has to interact with individual differences among pill users. For instance, their number of receptors, how sensitive their receptors are to different hormone influences, as well as their own reproductive health history, including their experiences around puberty, if they've had past pregnancies, how old they are. These types of factors all interact. So that's just an example of the heterogeneity among pills and among users that has been missed in a lot of research. And so I think it's important to consider some of that past work in light of these nuances. For me, some of the effects that have been replicated and are a bit more consistent actually concern mental health, which I think you mentioned, including things like depression risk.
Why would a woman who's breastfeeding take a mini pill if the body, while breastfeeding, naturally suppresses ovulation?
Because at some point, and it depends on the person, it will not suppress ovulation, right? It will stop. A child gets sick or is weaned, or all bodies are different. And so then ovulation will occur before someone has a first period or bleed postpartum, which would mean they're a chance for pregnancy. So the mini pill basically takes control of that, so folks know they are protected.
And if it was a regular pill, which included estradiol, that would mess with breastfeeding?
The thought with that, as far as I know, is that the minimal hormones are best. And so most simplistic formulation at the lowest dose possible. And to be clear, some folks prefer the mini pill, even folks who aren't chest feeding.
You mentioned the mental health effects. Would it be more useful to begin with mental health effects of contraceptives, which, like you said, are probably nuanced and still poorly understood, or something potentially more well understood like postpartum depression?
I think both of these things, what they share in common is that there's something, and some individuals have more psychological sensitivity to hormones. There's sensitivity to hormone transitions at all points in life, in general, and for some folks more than others. This is true around puberty, right? When the gender difference in depression emerges, it's probably not completely biological, but there certainly seems to be some biological influences of puberty on the gender difference in depression. So basically, before puberty, girls and boys seem to have depression rates that are quite similar, although really fairly deciphering what's depression and not in kids is an empirical challenge. But we see this traditional gender difference emerge around puberty and then at other significant hormone transitions throughout the lifespan. You also see these types of effects pop up again. Like you're saying, pregnancy and postpartum, where we're seeing huge increases and decreases, massive hormone transitions. And similarly, especially with hormonal contraceptive use, when it's a first use of hormonal contraceptives in folks who are younger. So it's really this change or transition in the hormonal milieu that I suspect, and I think the literature is pointing to, presenting some risk for some people. But over time, so folks who end up using hormonal contraceptives longer, there might arguably, there's some suggestion in the literature that they actually see some buffering to mental health challenges as they use hormonal contraceptives longer, because it's perhaps some bit of a stabilizing agent. What we don't know so well, though, is why some people choose to use longer. Those might be the folks who didn't see some of the negative side effects earlier. So they're the ones who continued to use.
For some drugs like caffeine, the body builds up a tolerance over time and you have to take more to get the same effect. And I'm not sure if that's the case with contraceptives. Is that?
I don't think that's particularly well studied. We do know that sometimes there are changes for folks, right? That they'll say, I've used this pill or I've used this IUD for years and everything was fine. And then all of a sudden, and we don't have a good sense of the all of a sudden why things may have stopped changing. It could be something about, I don't think necessarily a tolerance, but some changes in the feedback mechanisms that are related to environmental experiences or biological changes associated with age, for instance, or other biological influences as well. It's definitely a dynamic process, and we need to do a lot of work to begin to really figure out more about these nuances and really how to help best match people with a hormonal contraceptive option that's going to be best for them.
This large sex difference in internalizing symptoms like depression and anxiety that begins at puberty that you mentioned, I can think of three main explanations. It might be some combination of all of these. So one would be that it's anxiety and depression might go up in both sexes because adolescence is stressful and you go through a whole bunch of changes and you gain more independence. And what's really happening is that in males, testosterone is suppressing that increase that you would otherwise see. And there's some animal research that shows that testosterone reduces anxiety and increases reward sensitivity and risk-taking behavior, which is all a primary focus of my research in humans. So one thought is it would go up in everyone, except it's inhibited in males. The other thought is there's something unique about female sex hormones like estrogen and progesterone that increase depression and anxiety or threat sensitivity. And some evolutionary psychologists have came up with evolutionary theories for this, like at sexual maturation, females become maybe more of a target for males, and it makes sense to be more threat sensitive, especially if you have to take care of a vulnerable infant. And then the third would be the nurture, the environmental influences. So it could just be social learning or other influences like body dysphoria or becoming sexualized or predated upon, things that are more impactful on females than males. And it's probably some interaction of all of those. But the first two I'm more interested in, about whether you do see a unique contribution female sex hormones that increase the likelihood of depression and anxiety versus if this is some sort of baseline effect and androgens are doing most of the suppression.
Yeah, I agree with your initial notion that it's probably some combination of all of these things. And I would add that it's probably some combination of all of these things, and the combination looks different for everybody. there's lots of different ways to mix up those influences or combine those influences. A couple of thoughts. One, I think it's important to remember that females also have increases in androgens with puberty, right? So adrenarche, or maturation of the adrenal glands, which sit atop the kidneys, is one really important axis, we call it, of pubertal development. And those adrenal androgens, for instance, are responsible for things like body hair, pubic hair, play a role in underarm hair, that also emerge for females during puberty. So there is definitely some overlap in androgens and development. I will say, I think we need, and the field is beginning to collect better data in order to answer questions like the one you just posed. We do have many longitudinal studies of pubertal development, for instance, but this is challenging work to do. And sometimes the studies start a little bit too late. So we miss some girls who started puberty earlier. And often the studies actually don't go long enough to capture the end of pubertal development for boys, which could really be 19, 20 years old. And so we need data that are longer term. We probably also need more frequent assessments of things like puberty to be able to really map out where the changes are. And that would include better assessments of hormones themselves. There's a great deal of debate, for instance, about assays of estradiol from saliva, which is our easiest, in terms of research, among our easiest hormone assessments to get. But even getting valid saliva collection, this can't be like a COVID test. You drive up any day and actively spit into a tube. For valid saliva collection, you really want to have it collected as soon as somebody wakes up, before they've had anything to eat or drink or brush their teeth that day. And then you want to get passive drool. You don't want like the active saliva generation process of, say, spitting. Those are some of the challenges, I think, that contribute to our difficulty in answering these questions. I will say most of the research on pubertal development and depression, though, there's some studies that do seem to show some increase for girls with increasing pubertal status. So this just means how far along pubertal status is, how far along someone is in the process of puberty. But most of the work showing a strong link between puberty and depression relevant to the sex difference has to do with pubertal timing, right? Not just the hormones and where someone is in the process of puberty, but when they've developed compared to others. And that aspect of timing introduces other potential mechanisms or interactions with other potential mechanisms. For instance, it's not just about estrogen exposure, but it's about how developed the brain is, right? So timing, how developed the brain is, how old someone is when they have that exposure. It's about that type of combination. Or think about girls again. Girls begin puberty a couple of years before boys. So early maturing girls are the first of everyone in their cohort, in their peer group, to start having some of these physical changes. So not only do they have the youngest brains, so to speak, having these hormones introduced, but they also have very salient social signals, being the first in their group. And some of the first characteristics we see to develop with puberty in girls are breasts. So these very outward signs of changes. And so that type of complex interaction really creates some elements of risk. And that's where I think the strongest literature is. Not that estrogens or androgens in and of themselves don't matter, but it has to do with not just the hormones, but when and in what context.
That's the classic nature-nurture discussion we have a lot in our lab, whether this pubertal timing effect is driven by the hormones acting on a less developed brain, because there's a lot of research showing that cortical maturation, like the type involved in inhibitory control and executive function, is relatively independent of puberty and more age-driven. So it could just be the case that with that more developed inhibitory control, you can better handle this storm and stress of puberty. And then, of course, you mentioned the social environmental effects. If you're the first one to mature, you could get bullied or picked on, or you just feel like you stand out. And those could be what's driving these effects on your brain.
Mm-hmm. Or I'll say it again, some combinations of those things mm-hmm. and the combination in different proportion for different kids, but that it's such a dynamic and powerful set of experiences that we see the differences emerge nonetheless, even if the mechanisms do slightly differ for people.
Good and bad news for you building on all of this. In our lab, we've been working on this human connectome project and development sample with 1,300 kids ages 5 to 21. So that is a really large sample that's nationally representative and captures this full age range, even a bit before and a bit after puberty. So we're able to capture all those nuances that you mentioned. And this data is just finished collecting. And a subset of the sample has three longitudinal waves. So you can also look at within-person longitudinal changes. All of that is really good. And then on the negative side, we're using saliva for, and between those three longitudinal time points, about a third of the sample across either time point 1 to 2 or 2 to 3 have decreases in salivary hormones. And what is, if you're averaging across the whole sample, then you can detect reliable changes, increases with age in the hormones. But the way that I was interpreting this 30% decrease is just saliva is so noisy. It depends on how you sleep or what your stress levels are, what you'd recently eaten, even though we're following all these protocols of it should be in the morning before you brush your teeth, before you eat anything. There's still this massive individual variability. And because we're only taking one sample over a year apart, you don't get those fine-grained changes that are happening day to day, week to week.
Yep. It sounds like a fabulous data collection. There's so much going on empirically in hormone and behavior literatures that we're talking about. And I think so many groups and big projects, big labs, small labs are taking important steps, but one study can't do everything, of course. And saliva is tricky. There can be some of these decreases, as you mentioned, and folks can report that they followed the protocols you gave them, but to some extent, it's hard to know, you know, when they bring a sample into the lab, if they really did. It's important to understand, too, with girls or sex-assigned females who have begun menstruation in the midst or some cycling in the midst of adolescence as well. So then you have a menstrual cycle effect that's overlaying the puberty and the developmental effect. And as you noted, there's a lot of other things that influence our hormones. Season, time of day, right? Did they wake up at the same time? And so there's a lot of challenges here. But I do think we know, and as we're able to garner more resources and refine our methods, that saliva can be a good choice if we can get pretty frequent assessments. For instance, some of my colleagues have daily saliva assessments from adults across the menstrual cycle for 35 or 45 days. In those cases, you can use some statistical methods to smooth across some of that noise that you mentioned and at least have enough information per person then to get a reasonable shape of their trajectory or of their cycle. So this is possible, but it depends on a research question and the set of methods available to any group at any time.
The gendered cognition that we've been talking about, again, I've categorized it into three buckets, but let me know if I'm missing something. There's the psychopathology, like depression and anxiety that we've talked about. There's anything to do with sex, whether that's sex drive or attraction preferences. And then there's some work on spatial cognition that you've done. And that's interesting to me because there's a good amount of research, even in animals, showing these organizational effects of androgens like testosterone. And there's pretty reliable sex differences where males show better spatial cognition across some tasks. Why is that?
I think in humans, which is where most of my work is, although it's true, these effects are detected, but sometimes the sex better at a particular type of cognitive task can differ in animal models, different demands required of the tasks. But in humans, when it comes to spatial cognition, where we see the largest difference actually has to do with three-dimensional mental rotations. So this is of the most challenging tasks to picture it in your mind. Think of a whole bunch of cubes stacked together to make some sort of Tetris-like shape, but in three dimensions. And folks are shown that, and then they're shown other Tetris-like shapes. And they have to pick which ones are actually the same image or the same shape, but just rotated in three dimensions. This is the task where we see some of the biggest effects. Yes, there is some work that has been linked to prenatal androgens. We're also seeing in adults and in hormonal contraceptive users some replicated reports that it's low estradiol that is also related to that. So that overlaps with some of our conversations about puberty. Is it high estradiol or high androgens? Or in this case, is it high androgens? Is it low estradiol? Probably some combination. And it depends on the receptors and the sensitivity and the distribution of those for some folks. We also know with tasks like that, though, the three-dimensional spatial rotations task, they do respond to training. So you can train and practice and get some feedback on them and learn how to do better as well. So even though we see these hormone influences, there's also environmental and learning influences on spatial cognition.
It's popular among evolutionary psychologists to look at this and create an explanation like males are the hunters, so they need this 3D spatial cognition. And that's why over time we've been selected to have this improved mental rotation ability. But then you also see some of the effects in animals, even in rodents. And if you're making an evolutionary prediction there, it could even be the opposite. So one thought would be a null hypothesis is there shouldn't be any sex difference because both males and female rodents have to hunt and have to find food. But if anything, you might expect that it's even more important for the female because male rodents don't parent at all. And females have to find food not only for them, but then to nurse their pups. That's not what you find, though. You do still see the improved spatial cognition, which is maybe measured by maze time completion performance or something like that in rodents. So it must be some organizational hormone effect. What do you think the ultimate evolutionary explanation there is? Why would that be selected for?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to make evolutionary explanations for these things for the reasons you said, and because we can't go back in time and manipulate different aspects of evolution and see how they play out. My approach is to work more with what we have now. And in terms of that, yes, there are some sex differences that flip, even in the spatial cognition domain. For instance, object location memory is something that girls and women tend to do better at than boys and men. So this is, I don't know, maybe you've played this in a group setting at some point. Someone might come into a room with a big tray of objects, household objects, a bowl, a scissors, a hairbrush, a coffee cup, whatnot. And everybody looks at that tray of objects for a minute. And then whoever has the tray will go into another room and they'll maybe move a couple objects or they'll take something off and put something else on. And they'll bring the tray back and say, okay, you have to point out what has changed from this tray to the previous tray. That type of task, which it has a spatial element to it, right? You've got to remember where things are in location. Girls and women tend to do better at than boys and men. So there's a great deal of nuance in this. I think it's also vital to remember, we've been talking here a lot about hormones and sex assigned females and males and girls versus boys. But for most of the things we're talking about, these are distributions that highly overlap. And even though on average, men might have better spatial cognition than women, that doesn't mean every man has better spatial cognition than every woman. There's still a great deal of overlap. There's still a lot of women who have better spatial cognition than the quote unquote average man. And the same argument can be made for the spatial or object location memory example that I just gave. Just because women on average do better than this doesn't mean every woman is going to be better than every man. There's still lots of men who are very good at this and better than the average women or woman. And so this type of overlap also speaks to, I think, and reminds us that there's multiple influences and there's lots of different ways to be good at these types of spatial tasks. Some interaction between hormone elements or Y chromosome, dual X chromosome elements, or epigenetic elements. There's lots of other biological influences, right? Pubertal hormones really just turn on some genes. There's lots of ways and lots of mechanisms through which, biological mechanisms through which we might see these differences. And then they all play out in a very diverse, complex social environment that has unique affordances and challenges for everybody. So that's my note that, yes, there might be average differences, but a heart of my research program that we haven't talked about much yet is, but what about individuals? How do I know if that difference applies to me? How do I know for me, based on what my pubertal experiences were or my preferences about hormonal contraception, how do I make individualized choices? And I think there's a lot of work we can do in that space. And it involves research designs and consideration of the vast heterogeneity and kind of complex nature-nurture interactions that we all live through individually.
How do you measure those subtle individual differences?
Yeah, we get a lot of assessments from each person. A lot of work that my group does is what's called intensive longitudinal studies, where we'll follow the same individuals every day for, say, 100 days. And we'll get assessments if they're of their menstrual cycle, were you bleeding today or not? Or if you're using an oral contraceptive, did you take the active pill or the placebo pill that day? Or did you skip your placebo pills? Lots of people do that. And then we also get assessments of their daily cognition and their mood and their stressors that day and if they felt social support. And so we try to get these multi-domain assessments of individuals and then figure out, oh, for you, this seems to be a driving element in the experience of daily depression symptoms. But for you, depression symptoms don't seem to be key to your day. Instead, feelings of positive affect. If you feel good positive affect that day, that sets the tone for you. And so you need a lot of observations from the same people. So instead of comparing across different people, we can compare within a person, but just over time.
Do you work with genetic data at all?
Not too much. A little bit indirectly through twin studies, adoption studies, and some sibling studies, but not with kind of mass genome data from saliva or something like that.
I was thinking of these genetic differences in receptor sensitivity, and there's this paradoxical idea that one person could have more circulating levels of a hormone, but if they're less sensitive, then functionally it's as if they have less than another person.
Yep. Yes, I'm aware of those phenomena and some of those data too. And I think that's very critical in all of the work we do. That's one reason why I like studying things like puberty, because there are secondary sex characteristics. And so if you're seeing breast development, if you're seeing facial hair growth, not only is there hormone present, but there's enough of it present acting on those receptors, whatever their sensitivities are, or however many of them there are, to actually be influencing the phenotype. And so if we see them influencing the body phenotype, chances are they're acting in ways that could also influence the behavior. So that's some ways in which things like puberty or indirect hormone assessment, secondary sexual characteristic development, can be an endophenotype, a better endophenotype, closer to the behavior itself, but marking the biology than the actual biological assessment, say, of the hormone levels. Because just even though you might know the hormone level in saliva, you might not know what the receptors are working or how many receptors there are or how sensitive they are, the ways in which they're working.
This is a good place to bring up some of these interesting natural experiments. And the most extreme and most fascinating one I know of is complete androgen insensitivity syndrome, where you could have a genetic male. And I assume that a lot of these male characteristics, like developing a penis, was driven somehow by genes. And it turns out the Y chromosome just determines whether prenatally you develop testes or ovaries, which then start producing testosterone or estrogen. And testosterone is what leads to growth of the penis and all these other masculine traits. And if you have this rare disorder with an XY baby who doesn't have androgen receptor function, then you get the testes producing testosterone, but it doesn't bind to anything, and they develop as female. So that has this interesting implication for this female blank slate idea, which I want to return to because that's probably an oversimplification. But the female, or the XY baby, is essentially born and signed female at birth. And then you might think, okay, they don't have ovaries or female sex hormones, nor do they have functional male sex hormones. So they're destined to become a prepubescent child for the rest of their life. But they even go through female puberty because they have enough low levels of estrogen and progesterone, which males also have, to grow breasts and other secondary sex characteristics. They won't ovulate because they don't have ovaries, but they essentially live their lives as healthy but infertile women. And even gender identity and sexual attraction wise, most of them identify as women and most of them are attracted to men. So all of that points to hormones being the main driving factor rather than genetics, which both blew my mind and just really confused me. Okay, what then do the genetic differences mean?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And how do we study the Y chromosome? As the Y chromosome is really important because it carries the SRY gene, and the SRY gene plays a critical role in prenatal development, including androgen secretion. I think there are some other interesting studies getting at Y chromosome and biomolecular studies at like Y chromosome activation, showing actually that the Y chromosome seems to be getting smaller across chronological time. And I do think there's some suggestion of particular characteristics or behaviors that might be linked to genes on the Y chromosome. And I think some of the hypotheses surround aggression, but I don't know how strong the empirical data are because this is very difficult to study in humans.
And then another fascinating disorder of sexual development that we both worked on is congenital adrenal hyperplasia, where it's almost the opposite. You have genetic females who are most strongly impacted with high levels of prenatal androgen exposure. So they're a little bit masculinized during development. And you can see lasting structural and functional brain differences and differences in spatial cognition, like the ones we talked about, and even play preferences, and maybe some mixed research on gender identity or sexual orientation also being impacted.
Yeah, I will say most of our work on CAH is consistent with that. But interestingly, to highlight the kind of biopsychosocial context, some of our most recent studies have shown that girls with CAH, though they think about gender and they interact with female playmates in ways similar to girls who do not have CAH, so that there's some socialization of gendered influences as well.
We've covered a lot. We've covered individual differences, both at the organizational and activational level. We've covered at the other extreme, these different natural experiments or animal experimental research showing how manipulating hormones or genes influences brain cognition, behavior, risk for psychopathology. Covered some of the methods that go into it as well, including your intensive longitudinal designs, and all of the nuances and gray areas regarding how sex hormones interact with each other and how we measure it and what the difference is in sensitivity are and all that. Is there anything, Adrian, that we haven't covered that you'd like to bring up before we wrap up?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think I will just emphasize again what I think is most exciting about all of these areas of work, and that's heterogeneity. We've talked a lot about average effects, but that doesn't necessarily mean that any individual tracks those averages throughout their life. There's lots of influences we haven't talked about, I don't think, that we know about yet scientifically. And more importantly, I don't think we have a great sense about how all of these things can combine within an individual and set of experiences. And so most of us end up as this kind of wonderful array of differentially gendered traits and states that kind of change over time and across our lifespan. And so that's what I think is particularly exciting about this work, the individuality in it, and how we're trying, but we can't quite track any of our unique trajectory through all of these really rich set of psychological influences.
Thank you very much for your time, Adrian.
My pleasure.